call to order the Senate Education Committee on February 2nd, 2016. And this is our first meeting of the new session, which is pretty exciting. So it's great to have a big crowd. It's really horrible to have committees without lots of people in the audience. So thanks all for being here. And we hope you came armed with
suggestions. I kind of prefer that.
Exactly. So it's exciting for me. I'm really happy to be the chair again. And it's nice to have multiple chairs from the past around me. So as you know, on this committee, there are three former chairs of the Education Committee, one regular, and then two others that have been chairs of Education Committees in the building. So it's a passion for a lot of people on this dais. And I always like to say that with one of our committee members, his father was a State Board of Education person, Senator Cruz. So there's been a lot of family that care about education and doing it right in this committee. And I appreciate the president for having put us all together to do this. We're going to allow each of our members to introduce themselves, and we'll start down with Senator Cruz and then move across the dais. So, Senator Cruz.
Okay, Senator Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1, which is all of Curry County, about two-thirds of the land mass of Coos County. Arnie has the rest. About three-fourths of Douglas County and about one-fourth of Jackson and Josephine. Josephine County, I basically have the marijuana farms. I've been involved in these issues for a long, long time, and I'm pleased to be back here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mark Haas from Beaverton and Alloa area of Washington County.
We'll go to the far end.
You don't have any marijuana?
My name's Sarah Gelster. I represent Corvallis, Albany, Philomath, and the surrounding area.
Do you have any?
And our newest addition to the Education Committee.
My name is Dennis Linthicum, and I'm a senator representing District 28, which is all or part of five different counties, Klamath Lake, small part of Jackson County, small part of Deschutes, and all of Crook County.
Thank you. And I'm Senator Arnie Roblin, Senate District 5, parts of seven counties. We start in the south in Coos County and then move up to Douglas County and then Lane County and then Lincoln County and then Tillamook County. And then I get to move into the valley to Yamhill and Polk
Grant?
Counties. Yeah, I know. I want to get over there. I've always been trying to get on the east side, but I'm taking just Polk, parts of Polk.
Have you been to Grant County?
I have.
You been to Granite?
I have not been to Granite.
Okay. I've been to Granite.
We did an education tour when I was in the House, and we went to Eastern Oregon, my Ag and Natural Resource Committee. And so we went all over those eastern counties. And I found out that, yes, I have a long way to drive, but at least when I'm driving, I see things that are different up and down the coast. So
that's true.
It was always interesting to be on the other side. Though the only time I've ever seen a badger in Oregon was over in Eastern Oregon. I didn't even know we had badgers until it ran across the road. So it was interesting. So we also have a couple new administrators of our committee and legislative personnel that help. One was an assistant, and I'll first let Lisa, if she wants to say anything about herself. I appreciate having a new committee administrator, and I really appreciate the fact that the legislature decided to upgrade all of that organization, and they're really their own group right now up in our administration of the building. So thank you. Lisa, you want to say anything?
Lisa Gazelter. I'm a recent transplant from the also great state of Colorado.
There you go.
Where I spent 3 years staffing the House Education Committee. So I'm very happy to be here and be the new committee analyst.
Thank you very much. And we have an assistant, Dana. Would you want to introduce yourself a little bit too?
I'm Dana Frenchco. I've lived in Oregon, mostly Salem, my entire life, and I'm happy to be assisting the committee of Senate Education.
And this place doesn't work without the staff. I mean, all of you know that, but the reality is in Education Committee, and I've talked to Lisa, we try to be as open as we possibly can be. So if you have questions, you need to get a hold of people, you can get a hold of Lisa, you can get a hold of each of our staffs, because I think everybody on this committee is open to that. But sometimes the best way to get information, to ask questions, is to go through Lisa. So thank you very much for being here. With that, we're going to adopt the committee rules. They're the same rules as that every committee has on the in the Senate, and we appreciate the work with that. So I will ask my vice chair to make a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 1st of 2017.
And that Senator Lithicum has moved that we adopt the rules dated February 2nd?
First.
The rules are dated the first.
Even though today's the second.
The second, yeah. Is there any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, is there any opposition to accepting the rules? Seeing none, so moved. With that, we have some public hearings, and I tend to run a committee such that we have hearings first. We don't usually do work sessions on the same day because I think that oftentimes during the interceding time to the next one, we find out things we didn't know when we were having the hearing. And sometimes that's important. Most of the time, it just goes on in the next session. We try to move the bills if they are ready to be moved. We will find out today why we don't do that, because there's a couple of these bills that are going to need amendments, and we're going to find out about that today. So that's part of the reason, as everybody, including the agencies, start looking at it very closely with that fine-toothed comb, they find issues that they didn't recognize prior to that, and that's kind of what we're doing today. So with that, we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 20 and get a little bit more information so we can have Teresa and Cindy come on up. We had, in the interim, we did have a committee on ESSA, and they came and they had a conversation. We had some people from Colorado actually come and give us a little overview of the new nuances that instead of No Child Left Behind has given us. And so we're going to have a little bit of that today, along with some information about the particular bill, Senate Bill 20.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. My name is Cindy Hunt. I'm the Government Legal Affairs Manager here at the Department of Education. And today I brought with me Teresa Richards, who can introduce herself. But the reason that we created this bill basically was a placeholder originally because we were deeply involved with the implementation of ESSA. We weren't sure how it was out of alignment with state law, but we knew it probably was in certain places. And so hence the bill before you today. So Teresa's going to go over the basics of ESSA to give you kind of a grounding in it. And then after that, we can speak more specifically and answer questions.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. My name is Teresa Richards, and I am the Director of Federal Systems in the Oregon Department of Education. And I am here today to provide testimony on Senate Bill 20, and I will start out with a brief presentation about the Every Student Succeeds Act to give you some background. This is a big act, and it does come back to the Elementary Secondary Education Act that was signed into law in 1965 by President Lyndon B. Johnson, and it is it was a part of the War on Poverty, and it is a civil rights law. And the origin of the goal was to maintain, improve educational equity for students of lower income families by providing federal funds to school districts that serve poor students. That was the origin. And ESEA was reauthorized in 2002 with the No Child Left Behind Act, NCLB it was called. It put in place measures that exposed academic achievement gaps for students, particularly among traditionally underserved students and their peers. This is where our federal accountability really kicked in into our state. In 2012, the Obama administration began granting flexibility to states to waive some of the requirements of No Child Left Behind because the reauthorization wasn't taking place in the federal government. So they offered waivers that states then had to agree to doing some state-developed plans for closing the achievement gap and increasing equity and improving the quality of the instruction and increasing outcomes for all students. And we have been under that for some time, and just in 2015, President Obama signed the Every Student Succeeds Act, and this is the reauthorization of the ESEA law, and it upholds our nation's longstanding commitment to educational equity. And this was a bipartisan effort, and it is law as we move forward. So, tell you a little bit about what ESSA is about. ESSA offers new flexibilities to states and to districts to define what quality education means to for students within the state. And it does have parameters for ensuring accountability, but it does provide some additional flexibilities. It is founded on equity, as we mentioned. We want to make sure that every student has access to educational opportunities and whatever they need to learn. And that's despite race, gender, ethnicity, language, disability, family background, family income, or zip code. It is targeted to students with the most need. The law gives us flexibilities in four key areas, and that would be an accountability assessment, school improvement, and areas around educator effectiveness. But it does give flexibilities, but it maintains that accountability. There are parameters that we have to stay within those guidelines. The state then must submit a state plan, our Oregon ESSA plan. And we're approaching this effort to use the ESSA to really leverage what we want to do in Oregon. This is really going to be an Oregon plan, and the federal law is to supplement that. You may know that ESEA is the largest federal funding source that we have for elementary and secondary education. And it is to supplement, not supplant, state law and state funds. So in turn, states must show that they are working to meet the needs and provide quality education for all of our students. A little bit about the background of the requirements. I'm going to just share really high-level key areas of the law. First and foremost, supporting all students is an emphasis of the ESSA. The need for all students to have access to a well-rounded education that offers a comprehensive educational program to meet the needs, the unique needs of students, their academic needs and other needs, and to ensure that we're looking at individual learning styles and interests. It expands core subjects to include the humanities and social science, civics, the arts, music, PE, and all the other lovely content areas of STEM and computer science, technology, career and technical education. It offers opportunities for career counseling, accelerated learning, and it allows variations of ways to provide opportunities for students, and it offers real-world hands-on learning opportunities. And it also is to ensure safe and supportive learning environment for students. One of the criticisms of No Child Left Behind was that it tended to narrow the focus because of the accountability measures, and the focus on English, language arts, and math tended to focus on those subjects at the detriment of a full curriculum over all of the other content areas. There have been some school districts that have had to eliminate or not offer really a full curriculum. So that's a national trend, and that has happened in some places in our state as well. So rather than narrowing the curriculum down to a couple of content areas, very, very important, math and English language arts are critical, but they're not sufficient in and of themselves for student success. ESSA just provides an opportunity to bring back that well-rounded education. There are opportunities within the law that promote well-rounded education. There's a new formula block grant, the Student Support and Academic Enrichment Grant, that is designed to help students gain access to a richer curriculum. So there are some additional funds that districts will get to sort of build capacity in that area, as well as looking at flexibilities within the other funding programs, with the other federal programs. And there are opportunities to go beyond ELA and math and to offer non-academic needs, and for example, behavioral supports are something that can be done with the Title I funds. The ESSA also calls on, in our accountability system, calls on multiple measures, not just relying on academic measures, but to include non-academic measures, such as you could show advanced coursework, expanded learning opportunities, student engagement, looking at indicators to measure something other than the academic indicators in addition to those. And that then helps to broaden the curriculum and looking at creating those opportunities and fostering excellent teaching and learning. Standards remain. We're tasked to have challenging academic standards in English, language arts, and math and science. There are no federal mandates for which standards to use, so the state can adopt their own standards, or we are currently using the Common Core State Standards. States are also required to adopt English language proficiency standards aligned to our English language standards. And we also have standards for the English language proficiency, and all of the standards need to be aligned to post-secondary expectations, either college or career. Assessments require the same content areas and the same assessment schedule as we currently have. So we do test in reading and math in grades 3 through 8 and once in high school and in science as well. And states are allowed to add additional assessments. States are also given the flexibility. This is a new requirement or a new opportunity is to use nationally recognized assessments in lieu of the statewide assessment. And this would have to undergo a very rigorous process of vetting the assessments. The state has to first develop criteria and a process. Well, once we have established which assessments would be allowable, districts would have an opportunity to select that assessment for their schools. And a district would have to use either the state assessment, Smarter Balance, or and the nationally recognized approved assessment for all of the schools in their, all of the high schools in their district. So it's an either or choice. So there's a lot of work to be done to develop the criteria, explore that further, and we will be working on that over the next several months. In the accountability system, states have the flexibility to design their own accountability system, including multiple measures. And the multiple measures includes academic and non-academic measures. The academic outcomes for all students is still critical within the accountability system, but it does broaden our look at accountability. So the indicators listed there are the required indicators. We must continue to measure academic achievement in English, language arts, and math. We also can measure growth or other academic indicators in the elementary level. And for high schools, graduation rates are included. The four-year cohort rate is included, with an option to include, in addition, the five-year cohort rate. And there's a measure measuring progress towards English language proficiency for our EL students. And the new piece is allowing a non-academic, and not allowing, but requiring at least one non-academic indicator to kind of broaden out the accountability piece of this. And those can be a non-academic indicator could be such things as looking at student engagement, offering well-rounded learning opportunities, expanded learning opportunities, student engagement. You could look at chronic absenteeism, looking at a student's, if they're ready for graduation, looking at ninth grade success, ninth grade on track. So there are different ways that, as a state, we can measure in addition to academic. And this will take, this will have to be a statewide measure, so it has to be a valid, reliable measure. We have to come together as stakeholders together to decide what the non-academic indicators would be. In addition, and this is a continuation of the current accountability system, we do have to measure all student groups and to disaggregate the data and make public the data on each student group and how they're achieving across all of those indicators, not just the academic piece. So that includes our economically disadvantaged students, English learners, students with disabilities, American Indian, Alaska Native, Black African American, Hispanic Latino, Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islanders, Asian, white, and multiracial. Student groups. As states, will set their own ambitious goals and targets, and then have interim measures to show that their students are on track. With No Child Left Behind, there was a set goal: 100% proficiency for all students, 100% of the students to reach proficiency by 2014, and that. With the waiver, took that particular requirement away, and now with ESSA, we're allowed to set our goals that work for our state and our students. States must also design a report card that clearly communicates to parents and communities how their schools are doing, taking all of those accountability measures of school performance into account. States must identify certain schools based on those state indicators and our methodology to receive comprehensive support and improvement. And we would identify schools at least once every 3 years. States must also identify schools with specific student groups that are underperforming for 2 years or more for targeted support. So for comprehensive improvement and support, we're looking at the lowest performing 5% of all the student schools that receive Title I funds, and high schools with a less than 67% graduation rate, and schools with chronically underperforming student groups. For targeted improvement and support, it's looking at specific student groups that emerge that have been not performing for two or more years. And then with identification, districts have to devise a plan. It has to be based on a needs assessment, and stakeholders at the local level must be involved at the table, involved in the needs assessment discussion and identifying the supports that would be put in place, the interventions for these schools. And it really is too tailored to the local needs, not a one-size-fits-all model. States must approve and monitor the plans, and they should exit that plan in at least 4 years, if not sooner. And if they're not making progress in that time, then the state has to devise some additional supports or determine what the next steps would be for those districts. And the states must set aside some federal funds to support these schools in improvement, and these are the schools in most need of support. For the last of the key indicators where we have flexibility, educator effectiveness, the ESSA eliminated the highly qualified teacher or HQT provision of No Child Left Behind, and that was just based on qualifications of educators. It was a federal mandate on top of our current licensure or state licensure system. So taking away the federal mandate, that is just replaced with a single requirement that teachers must meet the state certification and licensure requirements. Under ESSA, states and districts must ensure that economically disadvantaged and minority students are not served at disproportionate rates by inexperienced, ineffective, or out-of-field teachers, and must evaluate and report on their progress in addressing those inequities. So excellent educators would be defined, the state would define what excellent means in terms of those characteristics, inexperienced, ineffective, and out-of-field teachers. We ESSA has eliminated the federal requirements on educator evaluations, but we do have state requirements for evaluations that remain in place, and a Bill 290 has been in place since 2011. It remains, and we will continue operating under Senate Bill 290. And with our stakeholder input, make some additional tweaks to the OERs that we currently have in place that were aligned to the ESEA waiver. However, evaluations must continue where our stakeholders tell us. The timeline for implementation of ESSA. In 2017-18, ESSA formally begins, and that's where most of the programs start. However, the accountability requirements are delayed a year, so we have some time to actually build that system. So this coming year, in 2017-18, this will be a transition year for us to design our accountability system and to begin identifying the schools for comprehensive and targeted support. So in 2018-19, new accountability system starts, and we have identified our schools for comprehensive support, and in 2019 we begin with our targeted schools. We'll have 2 years of data to show that. But just briefly, we have been in the process of designing our Oregon ESSA state plan in response to all of these requirements. And we are aligning this plan to Oregon's goals, our vision for education. We have been going around the state. Dr. Salam Noor and staff have gone to more than 30 locations around the state, talking to community members and educators and parents and students about their vision for education. So as we hear what Oregonians are telling us and we're looking to design our plan, we consider ESSA a leverage to get what we desire in Oregon, not the driver, but something that helps support what we are after. The consolidated state plan includes a number of federal programs, the program for migrant students, for English learners. This is the new academic enrichment grant that I mentioned that supports well-rounded education, after-school programs, homeless students, and as well as just the basic Title I, which is the largest funding source for our students with federal funds. And all of these programs need to align to our state goals, our state targets, and so we will be making sure that is outcome for them. We've been developing the state plan since the law was signed in December, including stakeholders from around the state and various sectors to participate with us. And in the early stages, we had some work groups around assessment and accountability and school improvement and educator effectiveness, and they helped us look through the law and look through our Oregon goals and make some recommendations for a state plan. We've been going back and forth with stakeholders to get their input and to hear what they have to say about that. So the stakeholder engagement and consultation and feedback has been ongoing and continues until we get this plan put in place. And also, I would say, it will continue once it is adopted and we are implementing. You know, this is going to take all of us together to carry out this plan. We will be submitting our state plan in April. We'll be taking it to the State Board for adoption approval in March, and they'll be having a first reading in February. So we're on track each month, each day, to complete the process for our state plan. We would love to come back and share with you information about our state plan. Anytime you would like additional information about how we've been addressing the ESSA requirements, we would be happy to come back and do so. In the meantime, anybody can contact the Department of Ed to provide feedback. Our information website is listed there.
So Senate Bill 20 that's in front of you is relatively boring compared to that because is that in four different places in Oregon law, it mentioned No Child Left Behind. So we went in and cleaned those out and put in ESSA. There was also one place that specifically mentioned highly qualified teachers. As Dr. Richards just mentioned, highly qualified teachers is a thing of the past as far as federal law goes. So we cleaned that out as well. So with Senate Bill 20, it's basically, you know, the little bit of a cleanup bill. As I mentioned at the beginning, we will be coming back to you hopefully during a work session and bringing a couple of amendments to that'll be more precise alignment with a couple of aspects of what ESSA did to federal law. And with that, when we come back to you, we'll be urging the passage of Senate Bill 20.
Any questions? It's nice to have great lawyers working on putting words in, like changing the name. I know. It was really fun to watch when I read the bill, and I thought, okay.
Yeah.
Wendy had a lot of work to do.
No. Yeah.
But anyway, any questions for the group? Thank you for the presentation, and thanks for being here. And we will keep in touch as time goes on. I really do, personally, we've been having conversations with SAT and other kinds of things, and can we use those at the level? A lot of parents have been asking, you know, I take this test, and it doesn't seem to help me when I go to college. I also have them take the SAT or the ACT. This aligns with allowing those, after they've gone through the process, to make sure they align as the indicator, at least at the high school level. And lots of conversations about our current testing and the amount of time that it takes. So a lot of teaching conversations with me and teachers about, is there a way we can do this in a more efficient way? And I think this allows us to have those conversations. Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, we'll Oh, we have Teresa Richards.
We have nobody else.
Oh, they're all done. That's everybody. Anybody else? I should always ask that. Is there anybody else there that have been sitting patiently, wanting to get up in front of everybody at the camera and have a conversation? I don't see anybody jumping at that opportunity. I will tell you that if you look at the older, the more distinguished lobby, they know exactly where to sit to not be in the camera. So it's always interesting to find out where you might want to sit. Though we do have them turn the camera on this screen, and they're right in the middle. So it's always, you know.
That was a good catch. The older to the more distinguished.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. Thank you. So with that, we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 20. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 138. Senator Dembro, and whoever you want to bring with you.
Who wants to come up? Yeah. Andrea was supposed to come up.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Yeah. Hello, thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. I'm Michael Dembro. I represent Senate District 23, that's Northeast, Southeast Portland. I'm pleased to introduce Senate Bill 138. It's a bill that I introduced at the request of the OCCA. It's an issue that I'm very committed to and very passionate about. As you know, and this perhaps Senator Linthicum doesn't know, but we've been working for a number of years on kind of recommitting ourselves to investing in career technical education. The real focus of that has been at the high school level or the K-12 level. We created the CTE Revitalization Grant Program several years ago, supported by, I think, every legislator. And it's a program that was, the focus of it was to reinvest in our K-12 programs, but to do it in a way where programs would be partnering with industry, with labor, when there were labor unions in that area, and with community colleges. And you perhaps know, students who go through CTE programs tend to be much more successful than those who don't. I think there has been recent reporting that students who go through full CTE programs are graduating at a rate 11% higher than the ordinary population. And where it really seems to be making a difference is among students of color, where we're seeing what otherwise would be an achievement gap becoming an achievement surplus, which is great. One of the, as I mentioned, concept of the revitalization grants was partnering, and this bill is trying to enhance that by seeing ways in which our K-12 CTE programs can better partner with with college programs, so that there really is a good pathway from one to the other. We passed legislation a couple of sessions ago that encouraged high school districts and community college districts to share their industry advisory committees to enhance that kind of partnership, partly to make it easier to create pathways from high school to college, so that within, in conversations with industry partners, they could work out, okay, this part of the curriculum is appropriate at the high school level, this part of the curriculum is appropriate at the college level, or in an apprenticeship setting, to really make a smooth transition. And what this bill, Senate Bill 138, is intended to do is to build on that, and perhaps to look at things like, are there intermediary credentials that a student can receive when they graduate from high school, and then are there advanced certifications, credentials they get as they move up the pathway into college, and ideally then into an employment setting. So what this bill is intended to do is to stimulate that conversation between the Department of Education and the HEC to really create solidified pathways, distinct pathways that will make it easier for students to gain not only expertise but also credentials. So, and with that, I'll turn over to Andrea, who can talk more about the details.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Andrea Henderson, Executive Director of the Oregon Community College Association. And as you know, community colleges are a place where Oregonians come for many different types of career technical programs. And one of the pieces that the community colleges have really worked on over the last 8 years or so, and really is a national leader, is on the concept of career pathways. A career pathway is essentially a plan, so a student can look and say, okay, if I take these couple of classes, I can get this job. And then I can go back to school and get this short-term certificate. And then I can go back and get a one-year certificate and then a two-year degree and maybe ultimately a four-year degree. But it's a really clear pathway for that student, and most importantly, that they know how their credits line up along that career pathway. And there's over 450 different career technical pathways that have been mapped across the state right now that gives those students that really clear sense. And also recognizing students don't come to school just once. They maybe can only go for a term or two. So they can really do some long-term planning around their career opportunities. Our hope with this bill is to really take that concept and ensure that as high schools are building out their CTE programs, that those credits and those specific classes are aligned with the community college career pathways and then ultimately for some into the four-year degree in a way that students are ensuring that every class they take counts. Everyone is important. It's part of the pathway, and they're not ever in a situation where they might take a class in high school, then come to the community college and have to retake that class or that subject area, that everything they've already taken counts. And so that's really the impetus behind this bill. Since the bill was introduced, we have discovered a problem with the bill in that the way it's currently drafted, there is concerns that it will set up a situation where it's considered supplanting federal funds, mm-hmm. and we could put at risk our Perkins money that comes from the feds. And we certainly don't want to put any risk at that. So we are talking with the Department of Education, and we'll need an amendment to the bill to ensure that it's really crafted in a way that's about that alignment piece, but doesn't put at risk any of our federal money.
Any questions? Yes, Senator Cruz.
I thank you, Mr. Chair. I fully support the intention. Okay, a couple concerns. Number one, we're tasking HEC with more stuff, and they've never even accomplished the first task we gave them. And so that's a problem for me. And this is a similar sort of action we're asking them to do, is alignment, and they don't seem to be capable of that. So from that perspective, I'm questioning whether we allow this to happen by rule or whether they should come back to us for us to approve it before it becomes something real. Just something to consider.
Any other questions for this panel? Thank you both for being here. And we also have Jonah, is it Hankinson or Harkinson?
Yes.
Thank you for being here, Jonah, and for traveling a long way.
Yeah, I'm up here for a week. So
okay.
I'll just let you go. My wife teaches at Klamath
Community. Oh, you need to introduce yourself.
Oh, yeah, my name is Jonah Hankinson, and I appreciate this. You guys are paying
Where
a lot
are you
of
from?
Klamath Falls.
Right.
Oh, okay. You want to know everything about
yeah.
me?
Yeah. Right. Everything about you.
All right. Actually, yeah. I ran for State House last year, one of the things that I talked to a lot of people about was education stuff. It was a big part of my platform. My wife and my father, as well as other people in my family, have been educators in my part of Oregon for a long time. My wife recently, my dad for 23 years. He's about ready to retire. And when it comes to, I talked to Mr. Linthicum yesterday, and he seemed to agree anyway about one particular issue, and that is into the point that you guys have been making about tasking the HEC with more work. The challenge, I think, is giving, because if I understand this correctly, 138 is basically asking the heck in the Department of Education to come up with a presentation to you guys, right? But when we talk about pathways and we talk about success and we talk about all these things are really vague. I think giving them a specific task, and again, to the point which what I've heard now twice, not only with this bill but with the other one, in terms of technical education, is a big, big deal. And so what I would suggest is requiring that in your legislation. If you're going to modify anything, give them something specific to talk about that will open up everything else, which goes to STEM requirements, CTE stuff, and so on. So, because right now there's nothing specific in it. It's pathways. Well, when you start asking people about pathways, I'm sorry, I'm not satisfied with what I've heard already. And I've talked to Mr. Linthicum about this, and now I'm not going to put words in his mouth. But he thought it was useful to at least raise the question, okay? And like I said, we have in my part of the state, during my campaign last year, I spent a whole bunch of time talking to multiple different employers there, Columbia Plywood, Quality Machine Products, and so on, and then also nonprofits that have to deal with the unemployed and the poor, okay, and people who didn't get educations and so on. And what I heard, especially with the employers, was like, we'd love to be able to hire somebody, but I can't find somebody who can turn a screwdriver. They want to find somebody, you know, they want to hire a local, they want to deal with it. But our industrial arts program has been gone for over 2 years, right, Dennis? And other things besides that. I mean, when I was younger, my best friend who graduated from Mazama High School, he at least had access to extracurricular vocational program, and he's got a really good job right now. But he's not working in Klamath Falls. He's working in Eugene because he can't get a job there. So this is what I'm getting at, is that I think the technical thing needs to be addressed, however you guys decide to consider it, and it needs to be the requirement for that presentation in SB 138. And that's where I'll leave it right there.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Roblin.
Questions? Senator Lethem.
No, I don't have any questions. The point in particular is what Senator Cruz raised. This specifically says, shall by rule establish career, and then we don't know what that establishment looks like, and details of the administrative rule enacted under section of the, and all of this is happening in rule offsite in another location. Specifically, Mr. Hackinson and I were talking about developing standards for having highly technical certification for skill level of some variety, and what that looks like in the wide field of career technical education could be hundreds of different options, and so it becomes very difficult to put your hands around it in the pathway language that we see in front of us.
I guess the way I would, if I can, I think the term I used with you in your office was, improving the student's technical acumen. Because there's a lot of people think that because we have these, we all know how they work.
I don't.
I know. I do, actually. But that's my background. But see, a lot of we have to get past that point and go to the point of, like, not just using the tool, but telling people how the tools work. Does that make sense? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Robin.
Thank you.
All right.
Anyone else that wants to have a statement or two? I guess what I would say is that, and I'll talk to community college people. They have, I think she said, 234 pathways that are developed. I think that's the stuff we need to look at, and we need to know what they're talking about. I can speak for one in Coos Bay at the high school I was principal at. We have developed a program for marine welding because we have a barge development in our town. And the high school actually produces most of the workers that they hire now, and they don't have to go to community college, though the community college follows it up with advanced training because there's other kinds of welding and stuff that has to happen. But prior to having those programs, it was difficult, and including finding mariners to handle the barges in Coos Bay, they have to go all over the world to find them because there isn't a training program that's specific enough that gets them trained to a level that allows them to pilot those boats or be the crew on it. So they go to Louisiana and bring people to Coos Bay to run stuff. And we've got to figure out how to take the education system that we're talking about and the community college system to help get those technical skills in our kids' hands, minds, so that they can take some of those jobs, because they're looking for people all the time in some of these industries if they have the right skills. So I appreciate your comment. We'll have to make sure that we have a conversation with community college so we see some of those, the outlines of what those look like. And I know they exist. I've seen some of them. So we'll continue to do that, because I think it's important for other people to see that as well. So thank you. Yes.
Just another Senator comment, because when we look at the workforce needs, these are where the workforce needs are. Everybody knows that. I mean, it's clear as day. You know, like right now, if we had, we could revamp or remake the industrial arts building at Umpqua Community College. We've got Toyota. We've got a whole bunch of folks that are ready to come in and do work with us now. And so that's, you know, I just want to make sure we're looking at doing some very good things, K-12 and CTE, and we need to make sure that we're doing the connections and not a general pathway, but we need to have some specific directions we're going.
Okay. Any further questions or thank you very much. We're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 138, and we will await amendments and other things that come for these two bills before we have a work session. And we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 55, Oregon Promise and the Cap, and Juan Baez, who, and oh yeah, thank you. There you are. Come on up. And Kyle Thomas.
So far into the session.
Well, good afternoon, Senator Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Kyle Thomas, and I'm the Director of Legislative and Policy Affairs for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. To my left is Juan Baez Arevalo, and he is the Interim Director of the Office of Student Access and Completion. And we're here to testify in support of Senate Bill 55. And prior to talking about the merits of the bill, Juan is going to give a brief overview and history of the Promise Program and where we stand today.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Linthicum, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Juan Baez Arevalo. I am the Interim Director of the Office of Student Access and Completion, OSAC for short. And I also serve as Director of the Office of Private Postsecondary Education for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. It is my pleasure to provide you with a brief history and an overview of the Oregon Promise Program.
We'll have it here shortly. There we go.
There we go. Senate Bill 81 of the 2015 session created the Oregon Promise Program and allocated $10 million to provide a waiver of tuition for community college courses. The program provides tuition costs for up to 90 credits. The minimum grant for a full-time student is $1,000 for academic year and the maximum $3,397 for the current school year. The Oregon Promise Program is designed to increase college enrollment, completion, and affordability for recent high school graduates. So who is eligible for the Oregon Promise Grant? The student must be a recent Oregon High School graduate or GED recipient. The student must have a 2.5 cumulative GPA or higher, must not have more than 90 credits completed or attempted. The student must be an Oregon resident at least 12 months prior to enrollment. And of critical importance, the student must plan to attend an Oregon Community College within 6 months of graduation. It is worth mentioning that the Oregon Promise is a last dollar program that builds upon other federal aid and state aid. Here you have three different examples. Student A, who has a lower expected family contribution, qualifies for a large Pell Grant and qualifies for the Oregon Opportunity Grant and receives a small last dollar Oregon Promise Grant. Student B has a higher expected family contribution, therefore a small Pell, and also the Oregon Opportunity Grant in a much larger last dollar Oregon Promise Award. Student C has the highest expected family contribution, does not qualify for Pell, does not receive an Oregon Opportunity Grant, and subsequently Oregon Promise, is the sole and last dollar source of tuition funding for that student. The 2016 application funnel that you see here provides you with the visual representation of the volume of high school graduates in 2016 down to the actual number that received the award during the fall of 2016. With 19,223 Oregon Promise applicants that you see there in green, you can just simply imagine the volume of work that OSEC staff processed as they reviewed and verified applications prior to making awards for the fall term. Oregon Promise recipients are throughout the state. As you can see, Portland Community College and Chemeketa Community College have the largest number of Oregon Promise grant recipients. Fall 2016 recipients are almost as diverse as the 2015-2016 12th grade students in our state. It is clear that we have some outreach work to do to increase the participation of African American, Native American, Hispanic, and Pacific Islanders.
That's a question right now. Yes, Senator.
Have you tracked number of students that graduated on an IEP?
We did not track it for this particular study, but it's information we can look at and see if it's available to us.
I think that would be helpful. And then one follow-up?
Yes, please.
So in the outreach, have you done any assessment to see why, for instance, African Americans are underrepresented but white, non-Hispanic are overrepresented? It just, when I was looking through the materials this morning, it looked like white, non-Hispanic students were above their average and every minority group was below. Do you have a sense of why that is?
You know, it's very early to tell. That's the first start of the program, first semester. I think we have some reflection work to do on our end to look at the statistics, start looking at breaking it down further in terms of school districts and demographics in those districts and to see the participation rate. A lot of it, and I'll get to some of this in terms of the college-going culture, and I believe this program is starting to demonstrate very definitely that is impacting that college going culture, and that's work that we need to do together. It is worth noting that a good percentage of Oregon Promise recipients were registered in the dual credit, registered for dual credit in their local community college as high school juniors and seniors, and you can see the increase there from the junior year to the senior year. It's that connection that they have already with college. This is indicative of a clear positive connection in the pipeline from high school to college, particularly from high school to their local community college and the connections that are there. Education Northwest conducted a review and issued a report on the Oregon Promise. According to Education Northwest's report, the availability of Oregon Promise grants is influencing students' post-secondary decision-making. So there is that clear impact already being seen. Nearly half of survey respondents who received an Oregon Promise grant reported that the grant influenced their decision to attend a community college and then transfer to a four-year institution. Nearly a third of first-generation respondents who received a grant reported that without the Oregon Promise, they would not have gone to college. I think that's a very significant statement there. According to the Education Northwest report, first-generation and non-first-generation college-going students agreed that Oregon Promise helped them see that college could be affordable and that hearing about the Oregon Promise made them think about going to college. That's very positive feedback for us, particularly as we entertain changes in our marketing campaigns and our efforts. So that clear connection of hearing about it, being informed about it, and leading them to college is a positive link for us to build on. As mentioned, nearly a third of first-generation college-going students agreed that without the Oregon Promise, they would not go to college. In closing, I would like to invite all of you to read silently the following student comments captured in the Education Northwest report. Perhaps you have heard similar student stories and voices in your local communities. Here are some additional student comments. I think the student comments tell us a great story about the impact that the program is having on individuals and their families throughout the state of Oregon. Thank you for your time and attention. I will be available should you have any questions, perhaps after Mr. Kyle Thomas's presentation or.
Thank you, Senator Roblin. I'll turn now to the text of Senate Bill 55, which chiefly aims to accomplish two things, one more technical and one a little weightier when we look towards the operation of the Promise Program in the next biennium. The first change is students are required under the current program to pay $50 per term as a condition of receiving the grant. The language you have in front of you actually shifts when that copayment is applied and how it's calculated so that it becomes less of a manual calculation for community colleges to achieve and it becomes a calculation that can be automated as part of their student enterprise and student billing systems. The second change in the legislation before you removes the $10 million annual cap on the expenditure that HEC is authorized under the Promise Program. This was included in the initial authorizing legislation, Senate Bill 81 from 2015, and it's in addition to any restrictions applied through the legislature's budget process. So even if we were appropriated $20 million in a particular year under this statutory cap, we would be prohibited from spending more than $10 million. So we are in the first year of the program right now, and that means that we are serving one cohort of students in the course of one academic year. As we look towards the first year of the next biennium, we will be serving both the returning class of the current cohort of students as well as the next incoming class. And so that's not really an expansion of the program. It's just a continuation of the program as it was initially designed. But what it means is under the current program design, we would be expected to expend, if appropriated, and under the governor's budget, we're appropriated approximately $20 million per year to continue the promise into the next biennium. Because of the statutory cap, we would not be able to expend those funds above $10 million. So that is the sole purpose of the legislation, really. And it is aimed and was initially conceived to affect the program in the next biennium. A couple of you are now aware, and I would be remiss if I didn't also mention, that under the current year of the program, based on estimates that we have and projections we have made due to the number of students, due to the credit loads that these students are taking, due to the family contribution or family income mix in the student population, we are expecting that in the current year we will exceed that $10 million cap. And the current range that we have is by approximately $1.5 to $3.5 million. We are not asking the committee today to expedite their consideration of this legislation to fix the cap for the current biennium. We're working with your colleagues on the Ways and Means Committees in leadership and the appropriate staff to come up with a solution that will allow us to appropriately serve the promised students affected by that cap in the current year. But we did want to make you aware of that issue. In a way, it's certainly a good problem to have because it means we've exceeded expectations in the operation of the program over the course of the year, but it does remain a problem that we are working to solve. And are optimistic we can solve within the current biennium. So that's the legislation. And with that, I'm happy to take your questions.
I guess I'll ask one question. So if we leave it in place, no matter how much money the Ways and Means spent gives you, we could continue the current program for those students for the next year, but we couldn't add any new students in, or vice versa. I mean, or we could say, you got it for 1 year, good luck for the future, and now we're going to have a new cohort, and they're going to get it, but we can't continue it for what was expected to be a two-year program.
That is essentially correct, yes. Because there are retention rates, and because not every student who receives the Promise Grant will return for the next year or even the next term, although we're initially projecting that perhaps term to term right now we're seeing retention rates of over 90%, so it's a significant retention rate and well above the average retention rate of the community college population. But you are correct. We'd either have to make a modification to the program, either by serving students for 1 year only, by adjusting the grant that's received in the second year, any menu of options to either ensure that there is money left over for the incoming class, or we just simply serve the returning class of students with, as you suggested, little funds left over.
So statistically, do we know, you gave that three categories of students, do we know how, what percentage of kids receiving it were in each of those categories? Not the amount of money they received, but the number of kids that were in each of those groups.
Yes, we do have some of that information. I can certainly bring that back to you and give you the details.
Great, you know, the people have said we need to make sure that we serve certain populations, and I know that's an argument. And we have some information in OLIS that have been given to us that says, is it best to serve the lowest income people, or in this program, it serves all levels of kids. And as we know, tuition costs, all levels of kids end up with debt if there isn't some help. And it was nice to read the comments. And so I just want to make sure that we're serving a lot of different Oregonians. I was heartened to see the distribution, though I agree with Senator Gelser. It would be nice to move some of those groups a little higher. And it would be interesting to know who the 3.5% that we don't know are, because if they went in the right places, it would have changed all those numbers. So anyway, it's just information. So. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes. A follow-on to your question with regard to the three categories, not only the number of students participating who fell into those categories, but what were the funding streams that went to those categories? Okay. Because there's a max of 1,000, right?
Up to a maximum of the cost of the tuition.
Yeah, and so that it'd be interesting to know, are they all pulling minimum numbers or maximum numbers,
right,
or whatever, and see what the not only the physical student count, but what the dollar figure looks like across those categories. And then one of the other statistics, it's not been in place long enough, but another statistics I would focus on collecting is, what's the successful job placement statistics? Getting a degree is one thing. If you're out on the street corner the next day with a degree in your hand, it doesn't help. And so what we really want to see is where, and this goes right back to our career technical ideas, how do you find those skills, mm-hmm, in today's culture and get people to be productive and successful?
Okay. Any other questions or thoughts? Senator Hass.
I was just curious about the mechanics, why we're seeing this bill here to lift this cap as opposed to doing it in the budget committee.
Senator Roland, Senator Hass, when we conceived this legislation and when it was introduced, it was on a timeline that we were unaware of the current year expectation that we might exceed the $10 million cap. We have kind of elected to separate those discussions because I think one of them is more funding related and one of them is probably more policy related. This is in the initial authorizing legislation for the program, and we thought it was an appropriate conversation to have here. That gets a little messier now that clearly we have to also deal with the issue of the cap and its effect on our current year expenditures.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes, Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, the information that you asked for, HEC provided to us in December, so it's in OLIS. So 53.3% of the Oregon Promise recipients, according to the HEC, their income was high enough that they were not eligible for any Pell Grant at all. And an additional 9.7% were eligible for only a small Pell. Only 12% were individuals that had some Pell, and it filled the gap. So it's in terms of that number where we're paying the full freight. For the majority of kids, we're paying the full freight because their income is high enough that they are not eligible for a Pell Grant from the federal government.
Okay. That's good. I'll look that over again. I thought I went through that one. But there is some good stuff in OLIS, and we need to read it more carefully. Thank you. Thank you, sir. Thank you. Any other questions of this panel?
Drop it into a message window.
Right. Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we have Andrea Henderson. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Andrea Henderson, Executive Director of the Oregon Community College Association. And I thought it would be remiss if I didn't come and talk a little bit about the community college's perspectives on the Oregon Promise and the experience they've had with the first term of the Oregon Promise. So first, I'd just like to frame this, that as we look at the Oregon Promise, we're trying to approach this by really looking at the underlying policy questions and really looking at the program to make sure that we get this right. And from the college perspective, for us, some of the key questions, is it making a difference so that students who wouldn't otherwise go to college are going to college? And two, is it closing the achievement gap? Are we getting students in that are in underrepresented populations, both getting them into college and back out the door? And so those, as we approach it, are two really key questions that as we're looking at the research and asking the questions about the efficacy of the program that we're considering. Obviously, with the numbers for the breakdown by ethnicity, our colleges are very concerned about that. We're concerned that we're not getting enough, particularly the African-American students in, the Hispanic students, Native American, and that to us is a question that we need to make sure that we're addressing and that this program is benefiting those students. So as we look at the program, we're also looking at, in terms of the funding, and how do we best help these students. For all community college students and really university students across the state, affordability is a tremendous problem. And affordability is not just tuition. It's all of the other costs for students, particularly for first-generation students, that the resilience, that support of the family. Many first-generation students are actually supporting their families as well. So not only are they going to college, they're also working not just to pay their tuition, but also to support other family members. And so generally speaking, we want to make sure we're looking at Oregon Promise in the broadest sense of how does this impact the affordability of our students? Is it taking the right step forward? Is it making that difference? I would say after one term of the Oregon Promise, we still have a lot of questions. We think there's some things that are working really well about it. Certainly there are students that wouldn't otherwise come that are clearly coming in with the Oregon Promise. Having the $1,000 minimum for the Oregon Promise is a wonderful benefit for our students that are from the lowest incomes because that gives them some additional funding to pay for textbooks to help support them. And that is a tremendous benefit from the program. But we also want to make sure that going forward it's structured in a way that really does work for students. We do have a couple of policy changes that we would like to see in the program. What was mentioned earlier regarding the $50 copay, we would prefer to have the $50 copay removed from the program. The way it's being administered, essentially the $50 copay is being taken off the top of the grant, and so for those students, for example, that would receive $1,000 under the program, we're receiving $850. Those calculations have to be done partly at the college level. It's an administrative burden. The colleges aren't seeing any revenue from it. It just becomes another piece that they have to do to administer and figure out what that particular student's aid package is without actually benefiting with the revenue. And secondly, and a larger policy change, is we'd really like to see the GPA requirement drop from the Oregon Promise. We'd like it to be available for all students that graduate from high school, that they have that opportunity to attend community college, whether it's to get a short-term certificate, a CTE degree, or to transfer onto the university. But for community colleges, we're open-door policy for all students, and we really want to make sure that all high school students are benefiting from it. The other piece as we look at the program that's really important is how does it impact Pell? And one piece that is very positive about the program is we've seen a tremendous increase in our FAFSA filings. Last year, Oregon led the nation in increases in FAFSA filings for high school seniors. That is a tremendous piece. And we don't necessarily have all the data yet, but asking the question, are we bringing more federal dollars in? We know we are. To what extent are we bringing more federal dollars into the state, and how is that playing out for students? And so I think as we look forward, balancing all the different interests of the Oregon Promise and ensuring that we're designing this in a way that works. I don't think we'll have all the answers this year as the program kind of rolls out, but we need to make sure that we're continuing to ask the right questions about it. I also wanted to mention briefly what some of the colleges are doing around the Oregon Promise students and how it's making a difference on campus. In the Oregon Promise, in the amendments that were put forward in the short session, we added a component that students that receiving the Oregon Promise had to participate in a first-year experience. We thought it really important to not only have the Oregon Promise be an access program about affordability for students, but also to think about the completion for the students. So we're not just bringing them in the door, but we're helping them get back out the door. And so from that, the legislature did appropriate a small amount of money to help students, to help the colleges design a first-year experience. What many of the colleges have done with that is essentially create a cohort model so that all of the Oregon Promise students are a cohort together to have specific programs that will help them to both retain and succeed. Some of them have monthly lunches with the president so that they're talking, how was your experience as a Oregon Promise student? How was this working? Some of them are taking first-year experience courses that will help with attention, with retention, and also teach them how to be more effective community college students. Some of our colleges have put together leadership classes for those students, but every college is doing something around treating that Oregon Promise cohort and helping them continue through their college education. We certainly don't have any numbers yet, but I suspect that we will see a higher retention rate with those Oregon Promise students because of these wraparound services. The legislature also funded money for advisors at each community college, depending on size, 1 to 2 advisors. That is also making a difference with these students so that they can better plan their college career in a way that they have the resources they need. So many questions still. There's many benefits from it. I think there's still some things we need to figure out and get right. But with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Any questions? I guess what I would say is I think that there are a number of people, including myself, mm-hmm. who feel very strongly that 2.5 was put in because we had to limit the numbers. I mean, if you look at what we had, we were told we had $10 million. That's why that limit is on there when we had that legislation. And part of that conversation required us to look at how you design the program to kind of meet that. And I'm amazed, actually, that we are within $1 million or $2 million, depending what the actual comes out. We limit it by grade point average. We limit it, and we had a lot of conversations about you had to be within 6 months of leaving high school. There's a bunch of those limiting factors that I would love to see. If this program proves to be an advantageous program for getting a new population of kids who would not have otherwise gone to college, and I don't really care about their personally, the parents' income is not as important. In fact, in some ways, especially if they're doing cohorts, mm-hmm. having a cohort of groups of people that have different experiences in that cohort having conversations together is a really good thing to help change everybody's life because they get different experiences. So I like those kinds of things. And limiting it because we only had $10 million and then making that go forward doesn't make any sense to me. So I appreciate that, but I do think we need to carefully look at some of the other ways in which we can enhance the program. That'll make it cost more. So then we've got to figure out how that works in this very difficult budget center. But I'm personally, to get something started, to see some successes, in fact, getting federal money back and helping those kids, and then to end it would be disastrous, in my opinion. So, Senator Hess.
I do share that opinion. I would support getting rid of the GPA or lowering it as well, but with this program, every time we do something like that, people call, I need 2 years, or what about dislocated workers? We'd like to do all of those things, but we needed to start off, get a good toehold, and so if we can do it, I'm with you. I think it would also help the diversity factor and provide more opportunity and continue to be sort of a game changer for thousands of families. The $50 copay, just some of us worked on this, was sort of a compromise because there were people who said, what about these students? Shouldn't they have some personal responsibility here? And what about a work study and making them do community projects and things? And the problem with that, as Tennessee found out, it's very expensive to manage, and just maybe for a four-year program it'd be one thing, but for 2 years or 8 month certificates or whatever, that was just too much bureaucracy. And so that was how we came up with a $50 copay. And if we can remove that, I think it would be easier for the kids. And as you and I have discussed, there's already some personal responsibility for these kids because they have to go through this hassle of FAFSA and pay fees. And so that, to you borrow the phrase others use, is that they have plenty of skin in this game already. So I totally support both of those initiatives to the extent that we can afford it. And these are good growing pains to have, as somebody said already.
Senator Gelster.
So in terms of the, you know, kind of being in a process where we're budget constrained, mm-hmm. I've heard a rumor that we're budget constrained
yeah,
in this
rumor,
in this cycle. Expanding costs more money if there aren't also contractions. Would there be room to consider something like we've got the floor, we've got the $1,000 floor that's the minimum that's helping those students at the, what you said is one of the successes, giving a little bit more breathing room, but also having a ceiling so we're not paying the full freight for high-income students. That's the part that I struggle with when I talk to students in my district, where I do have students that are in either the community college or the university that are struggling to stay in school because of childcare classes, and they're working full-time, and they're subsisting on ramen noodles, but they can't even get enough ramen. I mean, really, we've got young people that are making choices about food. And then on the flip side, students that otherwise would be able to go and totally be able to pay for housing and don't need to work, we're paying that full freight. So I wonder if there's any room to look at something like that to accommodate a more diverse population and limit the cost at the same time.
Senator House.
Probably we spent more discussion on the 3 years we looked at this on means testing or not than any other aspect. And you would be hard-pressed to take any of these students and find many from high-income families. It's just sort of a Darwinian process takes place. And we knew, because Tennessee was about 6 months ahead of us, and they found the same thing, that the students from Tennessee, the applications to Vanderbilt kept going up by double digits. Kids were going to go to Vanderbilt, whether community college was free or whether you paid kids to go to community college, they were going to do that. And the same, I think, is happening here. Yes, you'll find some from, you might find a handful, but is that worth, again, putting out a whole new bureaucracy to means test for these kids with the amount of money that you were constantly, that would cost more than trying to police the high-income family kids who are going there. I just don't believe there are going to be too many to go there. And if the issue is middle-class kids, mm-hmm. I have very strong feelings about that I make no apologies for trying to help middle-class families get to some level of post-secondary education. These families are those who were caught with not enough money to afford a higher education with the tuition that it is, yet they have too much money to qualify for financial aid. And so middle-class families, like in so many instances, the families that pay most of the bills in this state go to the end of the line. And so I think the way we have it, the way Tennessee has it, it works. And the means testing process will just work itself out in a natural order, although I'm sure you could find a few kids from families that might not need this help. And I just don't think that warrants a full-blown means testing bureaucracy to put on the backs of these community colleges or the state.
And so to be clear,
Sarah.
I wasn't... Oh, sorry, Mr. Chair. Out of practice.
I know.
May I?
Yes.
Please. Okay. So that I wasn't suggesting, I agree that would be burdensome. It's kind of like the floor and the ceiling, where it kind of creates a limit, not saying we're not going to provide any assistance, but putting some limit on those that are not eligible for any Pell Grant at all, so that those that are fully covered by Pell Grant, they're still getting $1,000 to assist them. If we were to say, you know, the maximum grant that we put out under this is $2,500. I'm in a middle class family. I don't think that I should be counting on everybody in this room to pay for my kids' college, because we can find a way to make that work. And I would rather that my general fund that I was contributing was helping us not reduce
the cuts that we're having to make in human services. So I think that's a policy debate around the middle class piece. I think you make a great argument. People get frustrated, and it is hard. It's not to say that it's not hard, but I don't think we've ever gotten any promises that life isn't hard sometimes, especially when we're not worrying about whether or not we have a house to live in or food to eat. And that's, I'd like to see more of those kids be able to come in.
If I may respond, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hass.
I don't disagree with that, but I just, let's look at the big picture here and say let's, I would say instead of like picking away at a new program that's just getting started, let's look at higher education. Let's look at the cost drivers in higher education. The University of Oregon has a president who's has a base salary of $660,000, not counting benefits. He has a $14,000 car allowance, and he lives in a state-owned mansion. And that right there represents about a tenth of what we're talking about. So if we're going to start looking at ways to save money in higher education, why are we going to pick away at this?
And I'm totally with you. And the only reason that I'm raising it is if we are going to follow up.
Senator Gilster.
I hear the concern about the 2.5. If we bring more people in, it costs more money. If we address the disproportionality issue, it costs more money. If we address the, whether that's racial disproportionality or regional disproportionality, that all of that is going to cost more money. I'm concerned about how do we do that in this budget environment where we know that we can't even afford to continue exactly what it is that we're doing today. If we were flush with money and you are successful in revenue reform, it's a totally different conversation. But it's, how do we make those priorities? I think the key is, yes, I mean, there are a lot of successes with this program, and the challenges of our budget and our inadequate revenue system put us in a place where these different choices that we have to make for Oregonians are somewhat unsavory, because we would all like to do all of these things, and then we have to start prioritizing things that we would prefer not to, because we'd like to be able to do all of them.
Thank you. It is always nice to have conversation. And you get to be up here to get this going. Yeah, exactly. You got to sit up here a little longer.
Are there any questions in there?
So thank you very much. Any other comments or questions? Thank you. Again, if there's anyone sitting out there who has been dying to get up in front of a microphone and wants to talk about this bill, we'd love to have you now or, I guess, forever hold your peace. That being said, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 55. Keep in touch to see what happens in the future as these bills move forward. Next, we have we're going to open a work session. And this will be on all of our committee deals. It has to do with committee introductions of bills, so committee bills. And we did get one over the last couple of days, so we're going to look at introducing it. So I will have a motion from my vice chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that the following legislative concept be introduced as a bill. It's legislative concept 2225, dated... Dated 10/7/16.
So Senator Lithgow makes a motion to introduce LC 2225, dated, what was the date again? Okay, 10/7/16, to be introduced as a committee bill. Before we vote on this, and most of the people up here know this, but I like to make the announcement, voting to put a bill in through by a committee does not indicate your approval of the bill, you like the bill, you dislike the bill. It has no indication at all other than it gets it put into the system so that it can be looked at by a committee in the future. So with that proviso, is there anybody who has a question or whatever about the introduction of this bill? Seeing no one.
Were we supposed to be paying attention?
I expect you to be exactly as you are, so okay. It's okay. And with that, is there anybody who opposes the introduction of the committee bill? Seeing none, it passes, and we have introduced LC 2225 to the body, and we'll send that off to the president's desk for assignment. With that, any further comments or conversations about our committee? Anything else you wanted to share with the people that you were? It's on the recording, so we can check on it later.
We can. You can. Okay. It's, yeah. We were speaking in code, however.
Okay, that's possible. With that, again, thank you, committee members, for being here. I am excited about our committee. I think there is enough diversity amongst our people that we will discuss and look at bills in a way that makes them better, and I appreciate that. And with that, we're going to close our education Senate Education Committee February 2nd. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Education Committee February 2nd. Thank you very much.
Thank you.